Thanks, Guy. It's so good to be here at Brasenose with you all. Apparently, it's the only college that has produced two prime ministers who served at the same time. Quiz question, does anyone know? Any ideas? The answer is Malcolm Turnbull. Yep, and David Cameron. There we go. It's funny, we used to laugh at the Aussies for killing off their PM so quickly. Who's laughing now? It was David Cameron, Brasenose alumnus that I wrote for many years. I was there with him in the wings of Conservative Party conference, handing him his speech before he strode onto the stage as the winner of the first Tory majority in two decades. I was there in 10 Downing Street watching him watch the results of the EU referendum coming in. It says something about the pace of politics that these events took place just a few months apart. And really, it has been accelerating ever since, through wars and pandemics and, yes, premierships. It'll be interesting to see what Liz Truss has to say when she comes to write her memoir, and to see what she calls it. Thatcher wrote The Downing Street Years, so maybe The Downing Street Days? Or instead of Blair's, a journey, perhaps a jaunt? But that's what I'm here to talk about today, is about memoir, specifically political memoir. Now, as a journalist and then a speechwriter, I'd read quite a few of them, but I never saw myself becoming involved in one until I got a text from my former boss, David Cameron, asking if I'd come and help with his. Now, he emailed me what he'd done so far. Chapters about childhood, about university, his earlier career. They were like something out of Brideshead Revisited, and I thought it really was all brilliant. I wondered what on earth I could add and whether I was up to the task. But I could see the challenge ahead. He was about to embark on the meat of the book, his time as party leader and prime minister, a narrative that would take us from 2005 until 2016, through the financial crisis, the expenses scandal, the Arab Spring and Olympic Games, the passing of gay marriage, a royal wedding, two elections, three referendums, countless European councils and innumerable prime ministers' question times. So the task was clear: to stop Brideshead Revisited turning into Encyclopedia Britannica. I hope my background in speech writing would stand me in good stead. Because in speeches, the personal stories arise from the points you're making. You're using anecdotes to underline your argument. Whereas in memoir, the arguments you want to make arise from what is one long personal story. In both cases, I would say, external input helps you to produce something that is more considered, more accurate, and yes, more personal and authentic. But I'll come on to that. So how did it all work? Well, in many ways, you already know, because the process was very similar to writing a speech. And like all good things, it came in three parts. The first step was the research. For this part, enter Jonathan Meakin. Topped with a mop of curly red hair, Jonathan is a whole government department distilled into one man. His role was to produce packs for every era of David Cameron's life, timelines, speeches, press releases, news articles, and it was also to unearth material that hadn't been published. But together we went to the Treasury to comb through the archives. We marvelled at the things that David Cameron had written back to his staff on the memos that they'd put in his red box. David Cameron called these his scribbles, and some really were unintelligible. But others were gloriously clear. On one reply he wrote to a policy suggestion, avoid. No, no, no. No, no, no. No, no. Which genius thought of this right now? No, just leave this as it is. Now, knowing my audience as I do, I suspect many of you wish that that had been his reaction to suggestions about altering Britain's relationship with the EU. It was actually about rerouting Britain's public footpaths. Quite literally, a road not taken. Now, Jonathan and I also spoke to people about working with David, and their memories were illuminating. I remember David being baffled by this. How on earth do people remember all these conversations so well, he said. The answer is simple. If you're the PM, you're unlikely to recall the detail of every meeting you've had during hundreds of meetings that week. But if you're someone who's talking to the PM, you're probably going to remember what he said to you. And those people's recollections helped us to piece together history, one anecdote at a time. David's then press chief, Gabby Burton, even gave us her diary from opposition. And it inspired a great opening line to a chapter about David's dour predecessor. It's June 2007. Gordon Brown is Prime Minister, and it does not stop raining. David didn't keep a diary, but he did something that arguably was better. Once a week, the journalist Danny Finkelstein would visit the flat above number 11 Downing Street, where David lived with his family. Now Danny, who is the sharpest, kindest, yet most unassuming figure in politics, would sit on the Camerons' yellow sofas, downing cans of Diet Coke and gently quizzing David about his week. The result was a raw, real-time snapshot of history. 50 hours of transcripts. What could one do with a cache like that? You could cash in, you could sell them to a national newspaper and drip out the most incriminating, embarrassing bits each day. Or you could make a really good book out of them. Now, as the writer Mary Carr puts it, if you let yourself tell those smaller anecdotes or stories, the overarching capital S story will eventually rise into view. And it's those small S stories that those tapes provided us with. But more than that, the tapes actually helped in many cases to set the record straight. And the book is called For the Record. Still get it on Amazon. Don't think we've got it here, sadly. We made the decision to quote directly from the tapes in some cases because at points they helped to knock down arguments that have been levelled against David Cameron. For example, people accuse him of considering a referendum on Europe in response to UKIP's big win in the 2014 local elections. But he's recorded as early as January 2012 saying that he thinks a referendum might be necessary. So the tapes were a gift, and the access I had to the speaker was a gift as well. Now, as a speechwriter, in-house and freelance, I've often struggled to get face time. I've rustled up keynote fare with only the barest ingredients. Sometimes it's ridiculous how empty the cupboard is, as some of us know. But on this project, I was by the author's side as he travelled the world. We discussed chapters as we cycled across the Golden Gate Bridge and ran past the Sydney Opera House. We sat on laptops in a cafe in Kyiv and streetside in Mumbai. We ping chapters back and forth between meetings with other former leaders, the Clintons in Johannesburg, Ender Kenny and John Key in Tokyo, and someone who can never really be a former leader, Xi Jinping in Beijing. This sounds like a book in itself, but it was actually just the backdrop to a process of thinking and reading and mulling, questioning, considering, that really gave us, you know, the basis of the book. So all that travel gave us a lot of time in cars and on trains and on planes for step two, the drafting. Now, I know there are people who ghostwrite whole books. There's that famous story of the literary agent who sat next to a cricketer at a lunch and apologised for not having read his book yet. "Don't worry," said the cricketer, "nor have I." I also know there are people who simply type up and edit. I'll never forget meeting a party grandee in David's private office. "This is Jess, she's helping David with his memoir," said a colleague. "Ah," replied the grandee, "taking dictation." We know speechwriters what we do. We're not typists, but we're not puppet masters who put words in people's mouths. We are collaborators. And yet we do have our own agendas. I did on this book, I saw my role as helping to put the reader in the room. I really wanted us to try and paint a picture. So there is plenty of colour in there, literally colour, from David Cameron recalling one of those orange evenings in July, to talking about staff sitting in the blue glow of their computer screens, and even the opening of chapter 17, which is all about life in number 10. I quote, "Downing Street, a strange row of a few tall mismatched buildings cowering in the shadow of the mighty Foreign Office. A little figure pops out of the shiny black door and sails down the road on a lilac-coloured scooter. Hello, Flo," beams the first police officer as she passes, his finger on the trigger of a machine gun. His colleague opens the iron pedestrian gate and the pink figure glides through, passing a photographer who is snapping away. As she weaves through the tourists on Whitehall, her knackered dad clutching a baby doll and a little glittery bag, accompanied by a plainclothes police officer, tries to keep up with her before they cross the road and disappear into a side entrance of the House of Commons. This is Florence Cameron on her daily journey to nursery, and this is the only world she's ever known. Once again, the recollections that David Cameron recorded us on tape really helped us to bring the scenes to life. The European councils, for example, are an all-round sensory experience. You've got the sound of Sarkozy rustling the French newspapers and Angela Merkel watching football on her laptop, the smell of Zapatero and Socrates smoking, the touch of De Rupo's hugs and the feel of Jean-Claude Juncker's kisses. All these details are really important. Not only do they make the prose vivid, but they make it a vehicle for your key arguments. In fact, we learnt as the book went along that the best way to communicate abstract ideas, policies, concepts and debates is to situate them in real-life scenes. From then on, we had a rule. Only retell history if it's through an author's through the author's eyes. So don't just explain what the Arab Spring is. Tell them what it's like to sit at your breakfast table at 5:45 in the morning with an espresso in your hand, reading a briefing paper that suggests unrest in Tunisia might spread to other countries. We also realised it was important to do the opposite of putting the reader in the room and actually take them out of the room. It's tempting to get buried in the narrative and motor along with a who, what, where and when. Sometimes you need to step out of the story and analyse the why. It's helpful to have a collaborator to press you on that. So in a chapter about Libya, we've got a reflection. I quote, "So much of the job as PM isn't just the deciding, it's the doing. Cajoling, corralling, convening meetings, questioning official advice, offering up solutions, being creative, seeking wider opinions, and keeping on and on and on at people until something happens." And thank you, Guy, for your book, for teaching me that that device is abundantia. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
So as you can see, the drafting is quite similar to speech writing. Apart, of course, from the length. We're used to writing, say, 10 minutes of remarks or a half-hour address or even at a push, and it really is hell, an hour-long party conference speech, but this was something else. It is essentially a 30-hour speech. Yes, that's how long it clocks up on Audible. Yes, I recommend 1.25 speed. I told you politics had sped up. Now, the third step will be familiar to all of us, editing. Now here, Danny Finkelstein is on hand to help tighten the text and expand where necessary, with a focus on getting the arguments right. But the job of hacking it back was down to me and the publishing director of HarperCollins, Arabella Pike. One of the biggest wigs in publishing, Arabella rides around London on one of those retro Peugeot road bikes, and she's about one of the most impressive people you'll ever meet. I remember raving to her about David's earlier chapters. "Oh, most of that I'll have to go," she said. "No one cares about the childhood," before she gaily binned treasured anecdotes like she was smashing family heirlooms. "Where's my Anne Widdecombe story?" David complained when we presented him with an updated edit, minus a story that involved the straight-laced MP, the BBC show Strictly Come Dancing, and His Holiness Pope Benedict XVI. But we weren't the only editors. Every PM has to send the final draft of their memoir to the government. That's the deal. You get to use the detail of your time in power if they get to edit it where they feel national security or the identity of civil servants is breached. But this process took so long that we were literally making edits as David recorded the audiobook, which, by the way, was a two-week process in itself. And then there's Buckingham Palace, which gets to vet anything that references the royals. One conversation, I'm glad, made it into the final edit. It's 2010 and David Cameron, David Beckham and Prince William are in Zurich making Britain's pitch to host the World Cup. They come up against America's voting representative, a man called Chuck Blazer, who's very large. In fact, he's so large he gets stuck in his chair when he stands up. As Cameron comes to make his speech setting out the UK's offer, he's nervous. Prince, our future king, gives him some words of advice. "When you go up there, just imagine Chuck Blazer naked." Now, the final in caps, "This is final draft," is then sent to the indexer. After that, nothing can be changed because it would knock the index out of whack. And that really is a vital part of the book. It allows people to go into Waterstones, flick straight to the back and check if their name's in there. Interestingly, Liz Truss only gets 3 passing mentions. Rishi Sunak doesn't feature at all. Now, I had a bit of a wobble at the start of this year. ChatGPT was just out, people were talking about speech writers becoming redundant, but looking back over my time working on speeches and working on memoir and comparing the two has given me heart. Because AI can trawl the web, it can hoover up all the facts, it can do a fair impression of a person, but it can never scan someone's soul. It can never dig up the points of connection that unite us all. Those things that we read in books or hear in speeches that make us think, ah, I get that, and make us identify with the author or the speaker. Now, the author I'm talking about is a guy who went to Eton, came here to Oxford, ran the country, made huge decisions, many of which you may not agree with. But this book hopefully helped put you in his shoes and in his head by drawing out those common connections that we all share and make the personal universal. That is what generates understanding. and it's what, in my opinion, makes a great memoir. Now, as for me, would I work on another book like this? It was an incredibly laborious process. The fact that four people mentioned in the book died while we were writing it, R.I.P. Chuck Blazer, shows how long the thing took. And I did miss the bish bash bosh of writing speeches and that rat-a-tat-tat of delivery, but I was happy with the book. Even The Guardian praised it, and they praised the welcome splashes of colour. So I would do something like that again, though I'm not sure there's much demand. Theresa May said she won't write one. Boris Johnson is writing his right now. Liz Truss's, as we've said, won't take very long. And Rishi Sunak, modern man, Silicon Valley fan. Well, he'll be turning to the latest tech for his ChatGPT. Thank you.